So we've heard at this topic, at this conference, we've heard a number of talks about systems that have a gap, right? Some of them more interesting than others. And we've heard some talks about some systems that have some that have a bulk gap, that have some gapless edge modes, and a few talks about systems where which are critical in the sense that they have gapless modes at some isolated points in momentum space. But I want to remind everyone that there is also metal. There's also metal, which is where, and so in these former systems, you know, the entanglement entropy satisfies an area law, in even in this second class example. But in this case, there's some logarithmic area law violation. They're much more entangled because there's a whole surface in momentum space of gapless modes. And so this is, in general, a hard problem. Okay, so there is some class of metals that we understand. And I guess, I don't know if quantum information people know about Fermi liquid theory, but I'm not going to review it too much. So some people understand some class of metals through Fermi liquid theory. And the basic idea of Fermi liquid theory, the idea behind it and the thing that makes it work, is that the degrees of freedom that live, that describe these gapless modes at the Fermi surface are long-lived, basically free quasiparticles. They look just like free fermions. And so one signature of these long-lived quasiparticles is if you compute the electron-electron Green's function, which will be a very important object for this whole talk, you see a surface of poles in momentum space, and these poles have the property that they're near the real axis. So in particular, if you look at at a given momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface, near the Fermi surface, the value of the frequency at which the pole occurs moves through zero frequency near the real axis. So it has a lifetime which goes to zero in some parametric way as you move through the Fermi surface. And so just to emphasize that I'm talking about an observable here, the imaginary part of this quantity is something that can actually be measured by angle resolved photo emission, where you hit your metal with some high energy photon and kick out an electron from the sample. You measure its frequency momentum. You know the frequency momentum of the photon. The difference is the frequency momentum of some excitation of the system. And so the intensity of electrons that you see as a function of that frequency momentum is proportional to the spectral density, the single particle spectral density. And in this Fermi liquid theory, that near the Fermi surface, that thing approaches a very sharp delta function with a finite weight. And so the finite weight you should think of as the overlap between the external electron, the sort of bare electron that you kicked out, and the quasiparticle. And so this the long lifetime of these quasiparticles is sort of a necessary thing for this theory to be useful. And for a long time, it was thought that this theory was inevitably the right description of metals, because one reason is that it does a good, very good job of describing many, many metals, and secondly, because this theory that I'm hinting at is it's a nearly stable fixed point of the renormalization group. Okay, but nevertheless, other things exist and are not very well understood. So as motivation, as an example of such a theory, of such a system that one would like to understand, is this so-called strange metal phase of high-temperature superconductors. So this direction is temperature. This direction is some chemical doping. And this is the superconducting dome. And so at a value of the doping, where the superconducting temperature is highest, above the superconducting temperature, there's this so-called strange metal regime, where the thing is a metal, but it is not a Fermi liquid. And I'll describe two ways in which it's not a Fermi liquid. The first is perhaps not the most prominent one, but it's the one that we'll connect with first, which is if you do this photo emission experiment, you do see gapless modes on some surface in momentum space, but their lifetime is short. Their width goes to zero only linearly in the energy. And the residue at the Fermi surface vanishes. And so I'll take this as the sort of working definition of a non-Fermi liquid, namely that it's a system where there's a sharp Fermi surface in momentum space, but where the excitations at the Fermi surface are not long-lived quasiparticles. And okay, but the second and probably more, I guess, more famous way in which this thing is not a Fermi liquid is that is the temperature dependence of the electrical resistivity. So in well-understood ways of dissipating current in a metal, the resistivity as a function of temperature goes like T squared or T to the fifth or some other power. But in these things, this resistivity is linear in temperature over a very large range of temperatures, which is not something that we know how to produce with a robust effective theory. Okay, so here's an opinion. So although these things are at low temperatures, or I guess it's at some high temperatures, are superconductors, from my perspective, this is a distraction. Evidence that we can think of, that it's right to think of this as a distraction, is that you can remove the superconductivity by putting the thing in a big magnetic field, and this linear T behavior of the resistivity persists down to the lowest temperatures that people can look at. So the state that I'd like to try to say something about is this non-supergenic state. That's why I'm referring to these things as metals. Okay, so let me say a little bit about one slide about the theoretical status of non-Fermi liquids, the non-holographic theoretical status. So in one dimension, there's a perfectly great example of the kind of thing that we're looking for, namely Luttinger liquids, where on a surface of momentum space, where unfortunately a surface is just a point, in one dimension, there's some excitation which has some power law correlations. So it's not a particle. The fermion operator creates something with these funny power law correlations, so this is a perfectly great example. But the problem is in higher dimensions. And so most attempts to kill a Fermi liquid in the sense of making the quasiparticles at the Fermi surface short-lived arise by exploiting a loophole in this renormalization group argument for the inevitability of the Fermi liquid theory, namely if in addition to the fermion degrees of freedom, there are other gapless modes that you have to include, then there can be relevant operators, which can make the Fermi liquid fixed point unstable. And so the most prominent kind of other low energy mode that people have studied is some gapless boson. And so there's a long list of ways in which you can get a gapless boson in your effective theory, and a long list of people who have studied this question, some of whom are in the room. I mean, because it's only at points. Yeah, okay. It's similar in spirit, though. Yes.
It's not on this one.
Fair enough. It kills the quasiparticles at points. On the point, right?
So you can put a stud in.
So the picture that you should have here is that this is the propagator of the quasiparticle, and we're coupling the basically through the current to some boson which the fermion can emit and reabsorb, and so then if you cut this diagram, that you produce an imaginary part which gives the fermion some finite lifetime, and in general, such things can indeed produce singular behavior in the self energy, which can result in a vanishing residue at the Fermi surface and a short lifetime of the would-be quasiparticles. There's some issues about the perturbation theory here, which are very interesting, which I'm not going to talk about, because there's a more important way in which these non-Fermi liquids are how to say, obviously not the only non-Fermi liquids and that we need to do better, which is that these things are not strange metals in terms of transport. So in particular, when we kill the quasiparticle by letting it emit these gapless bosons, these gapless bosons have most of their support, most of their special weight, at their low energy special weight, at small momentum. And so it's most probable that when you emit such a boson, it has a very small momentum. And so that means that although the quasiparticle with some definite momentum is not a long-lived state, the state to which it decays carries nearly the same current. And so this process doesn't dissipate the current, as a result of which the single particle lifetime, the thing that I've been talking about here, this one over this gamma, is not equal to the so-called transport lifetime, the thing that determines what the resistivity is. And so even in models of this form where you get something which matches the, say, the strange metal behavior, the resistivity has a different temperature dependence than this linear in QD. And so,
thing with alpha less than 2 rather than only those with alpha equals 1.
Okay, this is some nomenclature question.
Yes.
Okay.
And I guess it's also not clear that anybody has ever seen a power between 1 and 2.
So oh, many systems, it's clear, sure. Yeah, many in the world. Not just, they have fermion systems.
Okay, good. Okay, so the...
strange, but not strange enough.
Yeah, exactly. So it's clear that there's something else, I think. And so I think it would be valuable to have a non-perturbative description of such a state in more than one dimension. And
maybe the situation is desperate enough that we can even ask whether string theory can be useful here. I don't know. And so the way in which string theory can be useful is something that we've learned in the past, I don't know, decade or so, that certain strongly coupled many-body systems can be solved using an auxiliary, sometimes classical theory of gravity in extra dimensions. Okay, so I'm gonna review the meaning of the sentence on the next few slides for the many of you that I'm sure are not familiar with it. But let me emphasize that what I'm going to try to do here, what I'm going to do here is not to find the gravity dual of some material, of say copper oxide planes or anything like that, or even of a model of the material, you know, not even of the Hubbard model, but rather to try to find some system which exhibits the same long wavelength behavior, which has the same low energy behavior, or similar low energy behavior, and maybe we can learn something about, you know, what a better name for non-Fermi liquid, something like this. So here's the lightning review of holographic duality. So the simplest example, the most well-understood example of this duality, which is actually quite a bit more general, is the following statement. So a certain d-dimensional conformal field theories, relativistic conformal field theories, are the same, are equal to some theory of gravity living in a certain space-time called anti-de Sitter space. So this is a metric on anti-de Sitter space here. I'm just going to assume that everybody knows what a metric is. It's something that tells you the distance between points. And so here, this green bit is familiar. This is the metric on Minkowski space, right? This thing has Lorentz invariants. And ADS is just a bunch of copies of Minkowski space parameterized by this extra coordinate R. So this is a picture of anti-de Sitter space. So this is this extra dimension R. Each of these boxes is meant to indicate a picture of Minkowski space. And anti-de Sitter space is just a bunch of copies of Minkowski space at varying R, where the size, the sort of scale factor here, varies with R. And a fact about anti-de Sitter space is that its isometries, the symmetries of this metric, are exactly the conformal symmetries of a relativistic theory in one fewer dimension. And so here I've indicated a series of block spin transformations, so that starting from some fine-grained lattice in short distances and moving in some coordinate I've called R by some block spin transformations towards longer wavelengths. I guess I should have really drawn one of these Mera pictures, because this works for quantum systems. But a fact about this correspondence is that this extra dimension really should be thought of as the resolution scale. And in this sense, this bulk picture is a hologram, because excitations with different energies get put in different places in this direction.
With the symmetry in the one actual dimension, whether that produces fully the conformal symmetry of the critical point.
It does, yes.
So it's fully produced.
Yeah, so if the bulk geometry is exactly ADS, yes, that describes the vacuum of a conformal field theory, where all the symmetries are preserved.
I see.
The most important entry in this dictionary is that the partition function of this quantum conformal field theory, as a functional of whatever sources you want to put in for local operators, say, is equal to the partition function of the gravity theory, depending on the boundary conditions on the bulk fields. At this, I should have said, there's a boundary of this geometry, which is this associated with this short distance end. And of course, this isn't such a useful statement because quantum gravity is something complicated and hard that we don't really understand yet. But there are limits of this equation where we do understand it, namely when the gravity theory is a classical theory of gravity, in which case we can do this path integral by saddle point. And the saddle point is well peaked when there's some coefficient here, which I'm going to call capital red n squared, which is large, which turns out to be basically the Newton constant in the extra dimensional theory. So in that case, this becomes a classical problem.
And it turns out that the limit when this problem becomes classical is when the field theory has many degrees of freedom per point. So this n squared is the number of degrees of freedom on each site of the field theory. So it's a large n limit. And the basic dictionary is that fields in this n to de Sitter space correspond to operators in the conformal field theory. Their mass of the given field determines the scaling dimension. And according to this dictionary, boundary conditions on the bulk fields determine the couplings in the field theory. Think of the sources appearing here as determining the couplings in the action. And so different couplings in the bulk action, so varying, say, the max of some field, corresponds to just changing completely which field theory you're talking about. A simple example of that is if you change n here, changing the number of degrees of freedom per point, that's obviously a very different system, that corresponds to changing the bulk Newton's constant. And there's another important limit that one wants to take to understand simply what one's doing, which is that the limit when this gravity theory is living in a big anti-de Sitter space, when we can really use classical gravity just with just a few terms, corresponds to the strong coupling limit of the quantum field theory. Okay, and so let me say a few things about why we believe this crazy statement enough to try to use it to do physics. So the main reason is actually that there are many, 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 many detailed checks of the statement in very special examples. So these examples are relativistic gauge theories where the fields are n by n matrices, that's what this n was, more or less, with some extra symmetries, in particular with supersymmetry. And the kinds of checks that people have done on the statement are checking various things that can be computed because of supersymmetry or because of some hidden iterability, and some checks using numerics. But I'm not going to talk about those checks at all because those calculations are of quantities which, how to say, maybe are not of immediate physical interest. I think a more powerful reason to think that we can use this to do physics is that anytime anyone has ever asked this correspondence a question, a physical question, it gives a good answer. So there's a long list of physical phenomena that it's either discovered or rediscovered. And a simple example of that is the following. So this is the geometry which, so here I've replaced what previously was r squared over, was little r squared, with some arbitrary function of r. So that's some arbitrary function of r. It breaks this scaling symmetry. So this describes a geometry dual to some arbitrary Poincaré invariant state of a field theory. So it's Poincaré invariant because I still have this Minkowski space here. And in the case of a conformal field theory, a theory without a gap, this warp factor w, this function here, goes on, it goes to zero at some point. So that means, according to this cartoon, you should think that this RG procedure never stops. You reach a fixed point in the infrared. In contrast, in the case of a system with a gap, this warp factor has a minimum. And so that means that the geometry here stops at some point. You run out of stuff at some energy. This infrared region of the geometry is missing, and that describes a system with an energy gap. So a simple example of that is a confining gauge theory. It's simple from this point of view. Okay, so that was the review of ADS-CFT. I hope you have some idea So here's how we're going to try to apply this to study Fermi surfaces. So consider any relativistic CFT, this is just for simplicity, that has a gravity dual, this is the most important assumption, and it has some conserved U1 symmetry, which I want to think of as a proxy for the fermion number. Right? So there's some, I want to talk about some finite density of some stuff, and so I need some conserved quantity. And so according to the dictionary, another ingredient in the dictionary is that when the CFT has a conserved U1 symmetry, that means there's a massless gauge field propagating in this extra dimension along with gravity. And let's also assume that in this CFT, there's some charged fermion operator, some possibly composite fermion operator, which will be our proxy for the bare electrons. And that means, according to the dictionary, that there's some spinner field, some fermionic field propagating in this extra-dimensional geometry. So let's focus on the case where the field theory has two spatial dimensions. So now we want to put this field theory at finite density. And it turns out that to do that, we put into this anti-de Sitter space a charged black hole. Okay, so this is a black hole. This is the radial direction. This is the ultraviolet boundary where the thing becomes anti de Sitter 4. And this is the horizon of the black hole, which carries some charge into this gauge field. And then to find a Fermi surface following Sunksek, we'll compute the two-point functions of this, the retarded two-point functions of this fermion operator, and look for sharp features in momentum space at low energy. And to compute that two-vote function, this is what this correspondence is built for. We just have to solve the Dirac equation, the equation of motion of this spinner field in this black hole geometry. So we're basically scattering these Dirac fermions off of this black hole. Yes, please.
In this charged black hole game, you propagate on the boundary. You sort of restrict propagate on the boundary, you get a propagator.
That's correct. That's exactly correct.
Another thing is that so this charge corresponds to the doping.
Right.
I mean,
some chemical function, but
the black hole, but still at zero temperature. I mean, the
right.
black hole don't.
Right. So this is a funny black hole. So there is a black hole that describes putting the system at finite chemical potential and finite temperature, which is a simple generalization of this one. This is the so-called extreme old black hole, where we keep the charge high and set the temperature to zero.
So the extreme old black hole corresponds to zero temperature
yes.
finite doping, but
exactly.
More generalized finite
temperature. Right. Right. So I'll talk mostly about zero temperatures because things are sharp. Okay. So this is what I said in a little bit more detail. This is the metric of the black hole.
Let me not say too much about. And the only other thing I should say is that this spinner field comes with two pieces of data that will be important. One is that it has a mass. And as I said, the mass of the field in the bulk determines the scaling dimension of the corresponding operator in the dual field theory. And in this case, it's according to some formula like this. And the spinner field also comes with a charge, the charge with which it couples to this gauge field, and that determines the charge of this operator in the dual field theory under this global symmetry.
To the theory without a chemical potential in the conformal limit.
Exactly. Yes. So we're studying a conformal field theory, and we're breaking that conformal symmetry by adding a chemical potential. The chemical potential is a dimensionful quantity, and when I say conformal dimension, I mean conformal dimension in this short distance.
I'm confused.
Okay.
If a spinner field have a mass, their correlation function will be exponential decay. Will not be
in flat space, that would be true.
Huh?
In flat space, that would be true.
But on the boundary, it's kind of flat. So whether on the boundary is still algebraic, you know, for massive particle,
yeah. It's because of the geometry of antidissipations that this is possible.
But the boundary is extensive. Right?
That's right.
It's large.
Right, but
I see. You say there's the curvature in the bulk will cancel the mass, basically.
That's some way to, but it happens for any mass. Right, so it's not a special value of mass. I'm happy to explain this more.
It's really like an X-ray.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you should know what X-ray is.
<She's>
It's the same physics.
Okay, so let me make a few comments. So this mass and charge will appear in many formulas that I'll show later. It's important to emphasize that these are not
couplings of a given field theory. This is similar to choosing the number of degrees of freedom in the boundary theory. And so, in consistent quantum theories of gravity, we expect actually that only discrete values are realized. But because of large n, they're sort of dense. And we really don't know what values appear, and so I will treat them as parameters, but it's important to emphasize that they're not coupling. We can't vary them by staying in the same Hilbert space. Okay, so this is a large, complicated system that I'm describing with a density that goes like n squared, this big capital N squared, which is big to make the system classical. And by computing this fermion two-point function, we're actually probing a tiny part of it. So this is an important limitation of what I'm going to say. And finally, it's not made of the spinner. That's right. So in particular, the black hole could exist even if the spinner field weren't there. Yeah, so that's right. At leading order in N squared. That's right. That's exactly right. And in general, both in examples we understand, both bosons and fermions of the field theory will be charged under this U1 current. So when you turn on a finite chemical potential for this, it's some Bose-Fermi mixture. And what happens is a dynamical question. And so fortunately, we have a way to answer that dynamical question here. And so I'm going to show you some plots now. And in those plots, the frequencies are measured from the chemical potential. So 0 means at the chemical potential. And dimensionful quantities are measured in units of mu times square root of 3 or something. OK, so ignore this. The system is translation invariant. So this Dirac equation reduces to some ordinary differential equation as a function of this radial direction. Rotation invariance then lets us choose the momentum to point in some direction. So I'm going to show plots as a function of one momentum. And so here we go. This is so for some value of that mass and charge, the momentum distribution curve. So if I pick a frequency near zero and plot the imaginary part of this Green's function, the spectral density of the fermion, as a function of momentum, you see there's some special value of the momentum where there's a big spike. And this is the energy distribution curve. If I plot at fixed momentum near that Fermi momentum, near that special momentum, as a function of energy, this is now the imaginary part and the real part of the Green's function, you see there's this big peak. And so this was some particular value. If I plot it for some other value, it looks a little bit different. But so there's a peak, and this is a picture of this is the same data as a function of frequency and momentum. And so you see there's this peak that disperses through the chemical potential. It becomes sharp at the chemical potential, and you can see from this picture that this dispersion is not linear. So in particular, so it's not a Fermi liquid. The dispersion here is some power law with the distance from the Fermi surface, and that power depends on these parameters. And it's also true that in these cases, the residue at the Fermi surface vanishes. Yes?
Oh, you only have a static particle, or you also have a gauge field that property?
So the background geometry is a black hole, and it's a solution of the classical equations of motion for the metric and the gauge field.
But the gauge field, does the gauge field emerge on the boundary, or there's a dynamical gauge field on the hole?
How to answer.
My question is whether you can only solve a direct equation. Classic theory, you really need to do kind of QED.
So the leading order in this parameter n, and large n, all the physics in the bulk is classical. Yeah. Right, so that's right. And so the spinner calculation is also classical. I'm solving classical direct equations. Good. So these were some numbers that came out of this machine. Let me explain them. And so the way to understand them is as follows. The geometry of this black hole is the following. So near the boundary, which describes the part of the geometry related to very high energies in the field theory, the black hole just reduces to this into this interface where the conformal symmetries of this tuple one-dimensional conformal field theory are restored. But it turns out that as you move into the bulk of this geometry and approach this funny horizon, the geometry looks like ADS2 times flat space, times R, in this case, R2, which is related to just the spatial directions of the space in which the field theory is living. And by what I've already told you about ADS-CFT, the fact that this geometry has an anti-de-Sitter space in it means that there's some conformal symmetry. But in this case, it's not the conformal symmetry of a relativistic theory. It's some conformal symmetry where only the time direction scales, and the spatial directions don't participate in the scale invariance. And so we should think of this black hole solution as a picture of a renormalization group flow of this d-dimensional conformal field theory perturbed by this chemical potential to some non-relativistic infrared conformal field theory. And the idea for an analytic understanding of this of behavior at this Fermi surface, this low-energy behavior, is to solve this Dirac equation by the method of matched asymptotic expansions, where we solve it near here and solve it near here and match the two. And from the field theory point of view, this matching here, this matching in the sense of differential equations, is really renormalization group matching between this CFT and this CFT. Yes, please.
So 1 plus 1 d nature, or really 1 plus 0 d nature?
This is a very interesting question, actually. There is a certain sense in which it's 1 plus 1 dimensional.
It's chiral 1 plus 1.
Right.
It's chiral 1 plus 1.
That's right. Good. So the answer, so I'm not going to describe that calculation. This is the answer to that calculation. in the box, it's a little bit complicated, but it's color-coded. The blue parts, all of the blue things are things associated with the solution of, sorry?
But this picking in the chin.
He's also a little bit.
So this picture, this color is actually ultraviolet. It's associated with the high energy part. And this picture here is infrared. This color is infrared. It's associated with the low energy modes. The conclusion of this analysis is that the location of the Fermi surface, which you can see from this formula, happens when, so these parameters all depend on K in some analytic way,
the Fermi surface occurs when this particular coefficient here, for some value of k, has a zero. Because you see, if I set this to zero, then the denominator goes to zero at zero frequency. And where that happens is determined by the short distance physics. It's determined by the solution of the Dirac equation in this full black hole geometry. And this is like band structure, right? The location of the Fermi surface is sensitive to the microscopic thing, details. But the low frequency behavior, the scaling near the Fermi surface, once you have some zero of this thing, is determined by universal physics. It's determined by this infrared, this curly G, which is a correlation function in this infrared CFT associated with this ADS2 region. So it's a one-dimensional CFT where the only direction it scales is time. And so scale invariant says that it has to be some power law in frequency. And so this curly G, which turns out to be the self-energy, is the retarded Green's function of the operator in the infrared CFT to which the fermion operator matches. And that operator has a scaling dimension, which I'm calling nu, which has this form in terms of the parameters of this bulk geometry. This nu will appear everywhere from now on. Yes?
Way that you find a Fermi surface, is there some important different physics in that?
Right, so nu goes to zero is an interesting thing. It can actually become imaginary sometimes. So that leads to this thing called this some log periodic behavior, which happens sometimes. But that, I wouldn't call it a Fermi surface. So I'm going to focus on the case values of k such that the zeros of this occur when this thing is positive. Okay, so this from this formula, we learn about what's happening near the Fermi surface, and it matches the numerics quite well, and the conclusion is that the self-energy is equal to this infrared CFT Green's function.
And now there's an interesting dichotomy depending on the value of this nu compared to 1/2, because the form of the Green's function near the Fermi surface looks like this, and so you see at small frequencies, the location of the pole. So this is the motion of the pole in complex frequency space, depends on a competition between these two terms. So there's an analytic term associated with the UV behavior, the coefficient is real, and then there's this non-analytic term coming from this infrared CFT Green's function whose coefficient is complex. And if this parameter nu is less than 1/2, then this term dominates at small frequencies, and that means that you can ignore this linear term, and the dispersion looks like this, like I showed in the numerical plots, and this exponent is determined by this, by 1 over 2 nu. And because the real and the imaginary part of the denominator here come from the same parameter, that means that the pole moves in a straight line in the complex plane. And that's enough to say that the lifetime is short and the residue vanishes. So this describes a Fermi surface near which the excitations are not a stable quasi-particle. It depends analytically on k. So you can expand near kf. That's right. It's a funny thing.
General, the fact that singular bar is omega 2 nu qf times some scaling function of the appropriate ratio of k perp and omega. Now, is that not present at all, or is this just the low frequency? Is there some limit that you've taken?
I mean, there are analytic corrections in frequency.
But there are there's no singular corrections of which scale also with nu 2 qf.
That's right.
Nu 2 qf doesn't appear anywhere else.
It's omega to the nu 2 qf times the series in omega.
No, I'm interested more in the dependence on k-perf.
I don't know k-perf. Let's see. The dependence on k-perf is completely analytic.
Okay, yeah. So in that sense, it's very much like a local critical, which is not what you get in, at least we believe, in all the list of problems you mentioned earlier.
Certainly, from a service coupled to gauge field, you don't get this.
Yeah,
that's right. So then that may be good.
Okay.
Yes.
Your formula for Z there is interesting because your geometry, your sort of emergent conformal symmetry has Z equals infinity.
Yes.
Is there some geometric way to understand that value of Z that the Fermion dispersion function has?
So what has Z equals infinity?
This is a plus R2.
Is Z equals infinity in what sense?
It's the limit as Z goes to infinity of the things with finite Z.
Exactly. What's Z?
What's Z?
It's equal to infinity in the sense that only time scales and space directions don't scale.
Z meaning
the field is not space.
My question
is, given that this Z is clearly some emergent thing, also not immediately obvious from your emergent infrared space time.
Yes.
Do you understand geometrically how to see this from the shape of the Fermion wave function or something where it's localized?
It's so
From the point of view of a field in AES2, it's the UV dimension. It's the mass. It's the effective mass in AES2 of the field that determines this. We don't have a good theory of it. It would be nice to have. Okay, so this
so that's the limit where the overdamping is strong enough that it doesn't propagate, essentially.
You mean the equals infinity?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. So it's this inference CFT, which this is the Green's function, is like locally critical excitations. That's right. And the Fermi surface is you should think of it as it's coupled to that. I'll say more about this later. So this is the case when this parameter nu is less than a half.
When it's greater than a half, that means that the real part of this and the real part of this, in the competition between those, this one wins, and the dispersion is linear. And so in this case, there's this linear dispersion, and the imaginary part still comes from this term, and the pole moves along this is convex. It moves like this, a thing with negative second derivative, so the lifetime is long in this case, and the residue is finite. So this is what I think you should call this a Fermi liquid in the sense that there is a stable quasi-particle, though the mechanism by which it decays is not electron-electron scattering. And so the power here is not gamma doesn't go like omega square. Okay, so we'll get to that in a second. We'll get to that in just a second. Oh, sorry. There's never a value where it goes like exactly omega squared. There's always a logarithm also. Yeah. Yes. We'll talk about one in a second. This is a picture that you might be tempted to call a phase diagram, but you should resist this temptation because this M and this Q, as I said, are not couplings. So this is if you like, this is the landscape of holographic non-Fermi liquids that we've found. No, it doesn't make it really sound better. It's more accurate, though. And so as a function of the mass and the charge of the spinner field, there's some region where we don't find a Fermi surface, which is white here. The region in orange is a non-Fermi liquid in the sense I said, and everything else is a Fermi liquid with various values of the life of the exponent determining its lifetime. And this is more or less the same data. It's just a density plot of the special weight as a function of frequency and momentum. In this case, nu less than a half and nu greater than a half. But then there's the special value in between, where the competition between these two terms, leaves behind a logarithm, which appears here. And this behavior of the Green's function is called a marginal Fermi liquid and was introduced as a phenomenological model of exactly this electron response in this phase of the cuprates. That's interesting. Let me skip this. But as I mentioned, just matching the spectral density, the fermion spectral density of some material maybe is not so interesting by itself. Let's think about charge transport by this Fermi surface. So as I mentioned, there's we'd like to understand whether we can find something with different resistivity than these sort of standard behaviors. And so we can compute the contribution to the conductivity from this Fermi surface. There's an important disclaimer that I should make, which is that the contribution to the conductivity from the Fermi surface is actually not the dominant contribution. So we compute the conductivity by the Kubo formula. Basically, we just compute the current two-point function, which we compute by studying the propagation of this gauge field, the gauge field dual to the conserved current. And at leading order in this parameter n squared, the gauge field doesn't find out that there's a Fermi surface there. And we need to see the effect of the Fermi surface, we need to compute this correction at order 1 over n squared. Okay, and so this is a few technicalities, which I'll skip. Basically, the calculation is very much like if you look at a description of the calculation of transport in a Fermi liquid in a sort of field theory-ish textbook. So it's more or less this bubble diagram. And the only difference is that we have an extra dimension, that space is curved, and there's a black hole horizon, and there's some mixing with metric. And but most importantly, there are no vertex corrections. So the vertex corrections, which make this the calculation in the Fermi liquid very complicated, are actually down by powers of n in this calculation. And the conclusion, which I think I shouldn't take too much time to explain, is that we can figure out the temperature dependence of the DC conductivity, and it has this power law depending on this exponent, which is the same exponent that appeared in the special weight. Yes.
So your connection between the single quantum Green's function and the conductivity is no different from that in Varma's paper, for example.
But here it's justified.
The assumption you made was that there were no vertex corrections.
But here it's not an assumption.
Right. Oh, that's the most assumption.
Yes.
Yes. Actually, why there is no vertex correction? Maybe explain.
Well, it's pretty simple. So vertex corrections come from diagrams like this. So, for instance, here's the boundary, here's the gauge field. A vertex correction is something like this, right? This causes extra factors of n.
Just down by
yeah. Okay, so
sorry, one more question.
Yes.
If you didn't have the fermion, but you had a real bulk theory with the U1 gauge field, there would presumably also be 1/n corrections. So if those 1/n corrections would not be controlled by nu, do you have any idea what they look like?
Just without the fermion at all.
Yeah, without the fermion at all. I mean, if there was anything to
just
the
mixing of the graviton
and the gauge field. So presumably you just computed the fermion constant.
So like finite density or zero density?
The interesting distinction between this contribution and those is that this thing has a singular temperature dependence. So we can really cleanly extract out the Fermi surface contribution. It is a one-loop contribution, yes, in the bulk. Yeah, so he's asking about other one-loop contributions. There are other one-loop contributions. This is the only one that's non-analytic in temperature. There are other ones that know about the density, but they're analytic in temperature.
Have an invariant way to separate this one.
Yes.
So the other ones would contribute to the thermal conductivity or something like that, but not.
Well, no, they do contribute to the conductivity, but the temperature dependence can be.
What do you mean by that? How do you know that? So you don't know that.
We just computed.
You're talking about finite density contributions.
Yeah, so just other one-loop.
What are the phase of the other phase? I mean, how can you compute it if you don't even know what? Is it a superconductor?
No, from the bulk calculation.
Well, how do you have finite density without knowing what the phase of the finite matter is?
It's just a black hole.
The black hole is
a black hole with charge.
Yeah, but you don't understand it in any condensed matter sense.
Oh.
Well, within this framework,
there's
a
game
of rules.
I think your question probably relates to whether this black hole entropy have any dynamics on what happened, what's the fate of the dynamics.
Okay, so we'll come back to this question in just a second. It's the next slide. So we can also give it the optical conductivity. And interestingly, unlike this DC conductivity, it can distinguish the existence of the quasi-particles. So the behavior is qualitatively different depending on whether the quasi-particles are stable or not. In particular, for n bigger than half, there is indeed a transport. Okay, so let me get to this issue that Jacques was just alluding to. So this black hole that we've been studying has a very funny property. It violates the third law of thermodynamics. In particular, there's at zero temperature, it has a finite entropy, which is proportional to the charge density.
And so we all therefore expect that it has some instability when interactions are included. And so there are sort of two ways to think about this. One is that, well, this violates the third law of thermodynamics. Obviously, it's just nonsense. But I think a more useful perspective on it is that we're describing a state where various possible ordering instabilities have been removed by hand, which, as I explained, is something that one can explicitly and experimentally do in various situations. So, for example, you should think that we're removing some superconducting instability by hand. And I'll come back in a second to what happens if we don't remove the superconducting instability by hand. If we do include that. But I should mention that even in this situation, at finite n, there are various ways in which this finite grounds of entropy does remove itself, which is, so one way is that just the presence of fermions themselves modify the near horizon region in a way that goes like e to the minus n squared. And this removes the residual entropy and actually does remove the non-analyticity in the self-energy for frequencies less than some scale that goes like e to the minus n squared. So this is it's not a zero temperature non-Fermi liquid at finite n.
You mean what happens at zero temperature?
Yes.
At zero
frequency.
It's not very well understood. It's something else, but it's unrelated in frequency.
Yeah, but that's not accessible in the one-over-n expansion. Is that an instanton effect or something like that?
It's not quite an instanton. It's
Thomas Fermi screening.
That's probably a useful way to think about it. Yeah, it's that the finite density of fermions changed. Mm-hmm. Okay, actually, I can explain a little bit more about this in terms of the picture that I'll present at the end. Okay. Yes.
So you're talking here about the entropy. Do you know anything about the compressibility?
The compressibility.
Do you know for sure that it'll come out positive in this case?
You're asking whether it has linear instabilities. I'm pretty sure it doesn't. But this is an important question. This depends on what the spectrum of fields in the bulk is. So one way in which it can be just linearly unstable, in which case, I guess it's not the same susceptibility you're just asking about. But one way, there can be others, I think. But one way in which it can be unstable is if in the bulk, they're propagating charged bosons, and so these things arise in many examples, and at low temperatures they can condense. Break the one symmetry, and this leads to what's called a holographic superconductor. It's some somewhat awkward description of a superconductor in the field theory. And so one interesting distinction between the case of the spinner and the bulk that I've been talking about and the case of the scalar is that in the spinner case, this retarded Green's function only has poles in the lower half frequency plane. This is something that we can prove. But in the case of the scalar, if you did the same calculation that I just described, indeed one finds poles in the upper half plane, which describes growing modes of some charged operator. And the way to think about the difference is that, why this happens, is that the black hole spontaneously emits charged particles. It's something we know from pretty much Hawking. But unlike in flat space, because anti-de-Sitter space, it turns out, is like a box, they can't escape. And so you create a particle-antiparticle pair. One of them falls in. The other one tries to escape, but then scatters again and causes stimulated emission. But in the case of fermions, you just fill whatever negative energy states there are, and this produces the finite density. But in the case of bosons, they cause this phenomenon called superradiance. And so so a holographic superconductor is a black hole laser in this sense. Yes.
Solving some wave equations.
Yes. Yes,
it's amazing. In gravity. Yes. And then you're using some quantum reasoning to justify
it. It's quantum in the field theory.
Yeah, so what? I mean, it just seems...
It's an amazing fact to me. I actually don't understand it. But it had to be true for ADCFT to work.
Right.
It's a check on ADCFT that this works. I agree that it's alarming. so far, I've described some features of the normal state, resistive state of a system. I guess this is the most speculative thing I'll say. In the superconducting state in the cuprates, one sees a coherence peak appear in the spectral density. So in the normal state, there's this incoherent behavior, but below the superconducting temperature, there's a gap, and there's this coherence peak. Indeed, with a pseudo coupling between the spinner and the order parameter, this is what we see. The condensate produces a gap in the fermion spectral density. So this is momentum, this is frequency, this is the gap I'm talking about. And near the gap, near the minimum gap momentum, the quasiparticles actually become stable. And there's a simple picture of why this is happening from the point of view of the gravity dual, which is that the condensate in the bulk is lifting these infrared CFT modes into which, in the normal state, they decay. This is a nice mechanism. Okay, so let me end with a cartoon of what's happening. So this is a description of a Fermi surface coupled to a gauge field, where we have a Fermi surface described as a fermion. We couple it to some gauge field by some bosonic operator made of the fermion. The gauge field has some dynamics. In this case, small angle scattering dominates the transport. A cartoon of this holographic situation that I've described is obtained by taking a free Fermi surface and coupling it instead by some mixing term. So this is the free fermion operator. This chi is some fermionic operator in some infrared critical theory, where the Green's function of the chi is this
Curly G Green's function that I've been talking about. So if you compute the two-point function of this fermion with this mixing term, you just need to sum a geometric series, and you get exactly this function I've been talking about. And something you can check pretty easily is that in the case where this mu is less than a half, this coupling is relevant with the free fermion scaling. And so this is a cartoon this is a field theory, field theory mechanism for producing the same behavior. And in terms of this language, this back reaction of the Fermi surface that produces this e to the minus n squared behavior, you should think of it as just it's the back reaction of this Fermi surface on this inference CFT thing. Okay, so here's the conclusion. I think let me just say this last one. The main challenge is really to step away from the large n limit that, of course, is crucial for the calculations. So ways in which large n is a hindrance for us so far is that the Fermi surface in the system is a small part of a much bigger system in which there are many other charged objects and lots of other stuff. And secondly, at leading order n, the Fermi surface doesn't back react on this infrared CFT, and it's awkward to describe that back reaction perturbatively in n. And finally, the fact that this infrared CFT has Z equals infinity is also a consequence of large n. So I think these are the important things that we need to overcome to try to do better. Okay, that's the end.
The talk is open to small number of questions. Yeah.
So in your penultimate transparency, you have this nice field theory model. And I think probably you assume large n factorization in saying that's the exact.
Absolutely.
But that still doesn't assume strong Cook coupling.
That's
large n factorization versus weak coupling. So that's actually encouraging in some sense, right? But
but it's still using large
n. Right. But do you know any small n models where a similar summation would work?
No, I guess that's really related to this last question I mentioned.
I mean, this seems like a very simple kind of model to try and make work with a small n back.
That's right, and I think maybe it's not so unreasonable to imagine that such some bath of localized chi's could happen in some other system.
There's also the one Parkovian jar, which has very much the same flavor.
Mm-hmm. And then this looks like the NFT.
Right. That's right, so that's this comment, that here the local behavior of this Green's function is an output.
So,
yeah.
We normally believe that this is not correct. In the sense that these quote localized things are an artifact of approximation. They actually interact with each other, they have coherence, and so on. So, how can this be falsified here?
Well, that's related to this comment. That in some ways, it is also a large artifact. So, there it's an artifact of the large D approximation. Here it's in some ways an artifact of the large N approximation.
In the end, there's no free lunch.
Speaking of which.
Sorry.
Yeah.
No free lunch is the same initial with non foam liquid.
Can you go back to just the psi? Yeah, so you're Hamilton, you're Lagrange, this the psi chi coupling just looks like a Kelvin term.
That's right.
So can I think of this as some kind of bilayer system where I have my fermions psi and they're coupled by tunneling to another weird layer chi, which itself is a non-permeable liquid because it has this term.
Well, then, yeah, the chi is what, how to say it? The chi system is how to say it? Doesn't have a Fermi surface, right? It's a very weird thing where there are just these critical degrees of freedom at every momentum. Mm. But yes, I mean, and certainly I am. You can in the at large n in this expression, you certainly can think of them as separated somehow. Separate them in space might be a better.
So in one dimension, can I think about I have a sort of a free fermion wire, and then I have a Lipschitz liquid, and they're coupled by.
By tunneling. Yeah. So, but actually, I think
it's more like you have a Fermi liquid here, and every point of the Fermi liquid,
yes,
you have a different critical system next to it.
Well, different critical.
Yeah, yeah. It's really like an independent heat bath at every point in space.
That's more right. Yeah.
That's what it means.
Yeah, so actually, maybe a model.
Just means that they're coupled by irrelevant interpolators or something.
It's irrelevant in the case when it was bigger than half. That depends on the scaling of this.
No, that they coupled.
Coupled to each other.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Perhaps a way that one might achieve an honest. I'm saying a real implementation of this is to think about some Fermi surface on the boundary of something where there's critical excitations in the bulk. Where, you know, there I'm trying to incorporate the fact that that there's a lot of this stuff without having, you know, large ed at every point. But that also that doesn't keep them from coupling to each other.
All of this is connected to this factorization of the geometry, right?
Yes.
That it's R2 is just way too much.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Okay, so maybe we should close the session and